Five, four, three, two, one.
Freaking loud.
The Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up, and take it away. Take it away.
Every week, it seems like,
But Dan doesn't...
Last week you could hear it, now it just blows you out.
Dan doesn't realize that when it hits a certain volume, the compressor kicks in and just drops it down to like nothing.
Yeah.
It's just getting dropped to nothing.
Well,
dude, last week we had nothing coming through, and this week it's like it's blowing eardrums. Here's
something. I told you why, because
Windows
I'm here.
Sucks.
That's right.
Do that again, man.
Windows sucks.
Where's the other one?
What?
The other wave, the one with that.
I can't remember who sent them in, but they're really cool.
Linux
Wars. Oh,
I love it.
Ah, come on. Oh, that's why. Oh, here we go.
Linux Wars. Windows sucks. Linux Wars.
That's what we should play that for, like, put it on endless loop.
20 minutes, man. Just let it go.
That's funny.
Now we're going to get hate mail.
No, we're not.
Oh, yeah. We get mail. Yeah, no, why are you guys always complaining about Windows?
Who's bashing Windows?
The last negative email we got was the time after Erin came on, was talking about Windows at her job.
Yeah.
And the one person saying, I'm a Windows administrator. I don't have these kind of
problems. Yeah, I never see those kind of
problems. You're making things up, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, we make shit up. Yeah.
No, you know what?
We never have those kind of
problems. See, that's the thing. I hear that a lot, and I'm not saying that, you know, the people who say that to me are liars. Because I'm not saying that at all. My experience has been pretty negative. Always had problems. I hear people telling me a lot that... We don't have those same kind of hardware. We run a Windows network, and it runs beautifully, and everything runs great. We don't have those problems you're talking about. We keep up with the patches. Things don't crash. Things run fine. And, man, I've really got to take somebody up on this offer sometime when they're local and they say that to me, because I would love to come see it.
I've never seen it. I'll tell you, I'll take what you said a step further. I've been doing my job for a long time, and I'm going to call bullshit.
I'm with you, man.
I'm calling bullshit, plain and simple. You cannot have a large Windows network installation going on and not have problems with Windows somewhere. You cannot. And if you do, it's because your users are so used to rebooting to fix every frickin' problem every 15 minutes that, you know, that's why you're not getting calls about it. But... you know, I see it time and time again. I've never ever seen facility that's using Windows where nobody has to reboot their computer throughout the day. You know, at the very least, no one has to reboot their computer throughout the day. I mean, I can understand you know, you keep up with the patches and stuff like that. You might get by without having a lot of viruses or having some other if you're real anal about your software, maybe you can get by without having a lot of lockups or something like that. However, like the normal reboot to fix this here, there. Like, oh, ding, you have moved your mouse. Please reboot, you know? You just can't get around that stuff. At least I haven't.
Yeah, you're exaggerating.
I haven't seen it.
You're making things up again.
Yes, I'm making things up.
So, we sold some DVDs this week.
That is Mondo.
And somebody actually received it.
That is Mondo cool. And who was it that gave us the big donation?
Well, the first one was Snarkout. He gave us, you know, a nice donation on top of the $10 we're asking
yes,
for the DVD.
Yes, he did, Snarkout.
Thank you, Snarkout.
You
that's very cool of you.
Awesome.
I appreciate it.
That's going to pay our bandwidth for a whole month, man. That's
what is?
Awesome. Snarkout's extra donation will cover our TLLTS.info site.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
You know what ticks me off about that is I must have used a different card to pay the second time around with
that. Oh, is
that
why
extra.
We keep getting that?
Yeah, that's why every
notice.
Time, you know, it automatically debits my account, but then, like, I got to pay another $5 from somewhere else. Mm. And another thing, people out there, sign up on our Frapper, man.
Speaking
we only
of,
have 66 people. Lug Radio has, like,
Frapper,
400 and
something. Speaking
people.
Of Frapper maps. There's two maps out there because Alan went ahead and he created a map before checking the forums and you know seeing that somebody had already
well,
created one.
Post a Frapper map link.
It's actually
no, it's on our website.
Now.
I put
yeah.
it on the website.
So if you registered on the TLLTS Frappers page, go to the Linux Link Tech Show.
Oh, man, there's 26 people registered on there.
Yeah, I saw that. So all those people should come to the other one.
Alan, damn you.
I know. He didn't read the bulletin board.
And I'm like, I can't even see IRC chat. What I'm doing, guys, is listen. Let me fill you in real quick.
It's still on Windows.
I didn't get a chance to talk last week, Dan.
Look at all these people that are on.
Newer distribution on my laptop, my old beat-up 400 megahertz Dell laptop, right? So I was checking different things out, and I got the Ubuntu Breezy Live CD. It was the first live CD ever to boot on my laptop. Usually they get so far and just, like, you know, crap themselves. This worked really good, so I figured, all right, I'll try Ubuntu Breezy on my laptop and just see how bad it is on, like, a 400 megahertz machine, right? So I popped it on there and did the install, and sure enough, like, everything works pretty much. I had to disable hot plug to get it to boot up. Don't know why. Didn't really piss with it that much. But the one thing that I did notice is that my 400 megahertz laptop only has 128 megs of RAM. Ubuntu on a 400 megahertz laptop with 128 megs of RAM is not a good thing. Enough said about that. So, when I came in here today, we'll see how that goes.
And it's still
installed. Looks like I'm probably three-quarters of the way done with it already. Real easy. I don't understand it. You know, I haven't touched the keyboard for, like, you know, 15 minutes now. And all I did then was answer yes. So, I don't understand why people think Slackware is so damn hard to install.
Speaking of Slackware, let's talk to
Slackware. Slackalacka.
We have somebody who wants to come on and talk about his Slackware work that he's been doing.
We do.
Who is it?
And who would that be?
Guinness.
Brian, also known as Rignes, on the forums. Lug member. LV Lug member.
Brian.
And fellow P and beer. P and the beer.
Being a B and a J?
Yeah,
I don't hear him. You getting pulled him up? Ooh, huh?
Something.
Are you really running Slackware on that computer, Dan?
No.
No.
I just have the
lie like a dog. What is that running? Is that Ubuntu running?
Ubuntu. Breezy.
Ubuntu running with a big Slackware wallpaper.
Somehow that's not right.
Holy crap. What's taking this so long?
You got the other program open?
No. There we go.
Yeah,
that's
slow,
exactly
man.
What we need again, right, to have the
no,
sound.
I don't know, man. Ubuntu is really slow.
No. That was it was up and running, but it was trying to log into Skype. Anyway. Oh, there's a nonlinear video editor for KDE called KDE and Live. What did you just drop?
Yeah, that's the one that Dan Dennedy seems to be throwing his support behind.
Which
have you seen his blog? He seems to be involved with them in some capacity.
I didn't pay too much attention. I saw it yesterday for the first time, and I went to check it. It's not available for Ubuntu that I'm aware of, but I saw it's on Mandrake. It's in alpha stage right now, what it says on Freshly.
Dan, you still nursing that Boddington's over there?
Yeah. Oh, come on.
Come on.
Is it that time of the month again?
Something like that.
You know, we tried the IAX conf.
Oh, how is that?
Phone client tonight. That's pretty cool. Once you got it working.
I got kayaks installed. I haven't played around with it yet, though.
That's pretty cool. And like this, I defaulted to, what is it, GSM, the client. Yeah.
Here we go.
Hello.
Here's your sign.
Brian.
Hey, what's up?
How you doing today?
Here. Okay.
All right.
I'm doing pretty good.
Fantastic. We're going to...
I can't ask... What's that?
No, go ahead.
My 10 minutes of fame, huh?
9.5 now.
9.5 now? Oh, no.
Tick.
So go ahead. Tell us
tick.
What you're doing there.
Tick.
You guys want to know how I got this suspend stuff working, huh?
Right. Suspend on your laptop IBM ThinkPad, actually, with Slackware 10.2.
Yep. Slackware 10.2. It's an IBM ThinkPad T30. And one of the things I wanted to do when I was setting it up was get the ability to suspend to disk, because even when it goes to suspend RAM, it still sucks up your battery. So what I ended up doing was, first I tried the software suspend that was part of the kernel, and it just didn't like that at all. It would lock up, and you couldn't even resume it. So I found this project called Suspend2. That's over at www.suspend2.net, and it's a patch for your kernel. So since Slackware uses the vanilla kernel, it was really easy because the patch is meant for the vanilla kernel, and they have a really nice how-to, which I just followed on their website. So I won't go into exactly what I did as far as that, other than to say you definitely want to read the avoid data loss section, because there's some good advice there. I actually totally destroyed my partition once while trying to learn this, which wasn't a big deal because I was just setting it up. But you know, it was really bad. I actually had to reinstall. But anyway, what this suspend to stuff does is you can either suspend to the swap file, or you can suspend to a swap, or to a separate Hibernate file.
That you can
configure.
Thank you so much, dear.
Oh, ho, ho. Sounding excited there, huh?
Slurpee time.
Oh, yeah, it's Slurpee time.
But, Slurpee time, why is that?
That's when Dan's wife brings Slurpees for everybody.
Yeah. Wonder if there's something on the Urban Dictionary about a Slurpee.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Brian, go ahead.
Okay. Anyway. Basically, in a nutshell, all you need to do is get a ACPI capable kernel. Make sure you have ACPI set up.
Is that only with the 2.6 kernels?
As far as it's the 2.6.13 is the kernel I use, but they have a 2.6.14 patch, I guess, in the works. It's a RC9 or whatever. But what was actually the hardest part was getting the ACPID stuff to work. And I actually wrote up something on my blog to make it easy for me to reproduce this later. I'll paste that into the IRC if anybody cares. And what you ended up having to do, well, first of all, I should say my goal in doing this whole thing was to have it be not dependent on KDE or anything like that. I wanted to actually have it work with, you know, regardless of the window manager. So, what I had to do was, once I got ACPID set up, I actually had to tail the ACPID logs and see what the events were, and create a couple rules to deal with that. And I don't know how much detail you want me to get into. It's actually kind of boring stuff, but what do you want to know specifically? I mean, I could probably rant for...
How long did it take you to do all this?
For 20 minutes. Well, it probably took me a week in my spare time, but that was learning. If you wanted me to summarize it in a nutshell, it would be, you know, kernel with ACPI support, patch with suspend 2, follow their steps because it's easy, use tail-f on your ACPID log file, see what your events are. And on that link that I pasted, I have what the events looked like and actually how to capture them and where to put all the files. But once you had ACPID set up and you had suspend 2 working, all you have to do is capture these events and have it run the Hibernate script so when you close the lid. Every time you close the lid, ACPID generates an event of some sort. And you have to figure out what your events are depending on your notebook, I guess. I don't know if it's different between notebooks.
You know what I want to see?
But once you got that, then what do you want to see?
I don't want to see it. I want to hear it. You should do a twat on this.
You want to hear what?
I want to hear you do a twat about this.
You want a twat on this?
Yeah.
Because everybody needs a twat.
That would be a fantastic episode. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Like that? Is this stuff really hard to get going? Because I know China where you do the 5 to 10 minute little episodes.
Right.
And you just send it in and they play it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but what I'm wondering is, you know, is like this suspending stuff really actually hard to do in Linux? Because I really didn't have any preconceived notions when I started this little project of mine. And when I told you guys that I actually got it working, you seemed kind of surprised and interested. So, you know, did I just get lucky here?
Well, I tell you what, I've never gotten it working. I really haven't invested a lot of time in it or anything. But I still have never gotten it working other than, you know, just running like APMD so that, you know, when I tell my laptop to shut the hell off, it does. Other than that, no suspend, no nothing.
I think the problem is you're a little ahead of the curve there, Brian, particularly with using Slackware or a kind of, you know,
mean
less...
ahead of the curve?
Yeah, a little, like, I believe...
I consider myself a newbie.
SUSE and Ubuntu are doing pretty well with the, I hear we're doing pretty well to suspend the disk. Some of the newer distributions, latest releases, using the latest kernels are doing really well with that. But Slackware...
Actually...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, actually, specifically Ubuntu and SUSE were... Supposedly, this works out of the box. I haven't tried it, but I've seen elsewhere on forums that they're actually really good with this.
Yeah,
Slackware is. I mean, if somebody wants to really get into the nitty gritty of it, you know, they can just look at that link that I posted on the IRC. Because even though it's written specifically for my ThinkPad, I'm sure it's easy to modify towards another, you know, another piece of hardware.
Yeah, and I think that's it right there. With Slackware, again, you're doing it yourself. They don't have all that stuff written up yet. Yeah. And I think that you're ahead of the game.
Yeah.
You can join the Gentoo users.
Oh, jeez. Oh, come on.
The GCC screensaver?
That's a Slackware guy. What's that?
The GCC screensaver.
GCC screensaver? Oh, yeah. Gentoo. I've never actually tried to install Gentoo.
You're lucky.
Mostly because I have a life and can't sit and watch a compile for weeks.
Yeah, we're going to get hate mail again.
But,
No.
It's the truth, though.
It's not like that. You don't sit and watch a compile. You just... You need to have a spare computer to install Gentoo on. So you can let it do its compile, and you can walk away and use your Slackware box, which is already running. Right?
Hey, you know what? One thing that I, going back to laptops for just a second, that I wanted to mention, one thing that I found out, and was actually hard to find, was K-Hotswap for, like, swapping your bays. It works real nice. So you don't have to power off your laptop. When you want to, say, put your floppy in take out your CD and put your floppy in.
Nifty. K-Hotswap.
I can't wait to get a laptop.
What's that? What's that? You need to get a laptop?
Yeah, I can't wait to get a new laptop, man. It's not going to happen until after New Year's, though.
Why is that?
I don't have the cash for it.
Oh, you know what? In all fairness, for me getting the setup, I guess IBM laptops are very Linux-friendly.
Yes.
They better be. Well, they don't make laptops anymore.
Yeah, they better be.
Yeah, it's Lenio. It's a Chinese company.
That's right. I heard they went and had other people make them, but I'm sure IBM still designs them. Just has. Well, I don't know. Maybe they don't.
Who knows what the deal is?
But even though everything else in there still works with Linux mice, except for the modem, because it has a freaking Win modem in it.
But who needs a modem anyhow?
You guys need to install Canonix and life will be easy.
Bah.
Supposedly you can get it working with the Win modem project. But Canonix. I haven't tried Canonix yet.
It's great.
What's that about?
It's Debian derivative. It's built with some components of Nopix. But it's a great live distro, and it's really awesome when you install. It takes about 20 minutes. And you get the latest and greatest package. It's like Debian SID, but much more stable and much more current. It's real good. New version's coming out very soon.
Just don't try it on your old laptop like I did because it doesn't load.
Try it out. So it's a, what's this?
It's a bootable, but you can but you can also install it. It's a great bootable distro, but it's also awesome.
Okay. You can do it with Nopix.
Yeah, but you can also install it, and it's really good once you install it, unlike Nopix. I installed Nopix on a hard drive once, and it was okay for a couple of days, but after a while, once you start installing stuff, you start running into dependency issues.
On Canonix?
No, on Nopix. If you install Nopix onto a hard drive.
Dependency issues, that's...
Okay.
Well, actually, I thought I saw something about converting a Nopix install into essentially a Debian.
Well, don't waste your time.
I have the instructions somewhere around here.
Just go with Canonix. It's basically Debian SID, but with like KDE really souped up and fast.
Really?
Yeah, it's nice. Check it out.
Well, Brian.
All right, cool. I'll have to try it out. Is it good for utilities and stuff, like fixing Windows?
Yeah, it's great, man. I love it.
I don't know. I've never used it.
Right, cool.
Other than that install that one time. Never tried using it live.
The new version's coming out very soon.
I'm surprised you don't have an alpha copy already.
You know, I like doing things with applications and actually doing some stuff. Some people like to just install and try it. I don't know. I'll wait for the new version to come out and hear if there are any horror stories before doing the upgrade.
Well, what are you going to do?
I'll wait till a week or two afterwards.
Don't know, but I bet you're going to tell us.
Of course.
Brian, we got to get going, man. Right. We got to call our guest tonight. Our other guest, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Other guest.
Yes.
Well, hopefully I wasn't too crazy with this. So anyway.
No, great. Great stuff.
Nice talking to you guys.
Yeah, I'll see you Saturday.
Thanks, Brian.
All right.
Have a good one.
See ya. Have a good one. Yep.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Saturday. What's going on Saturday? You got a date.
Got a train going on. Woo, woo. Now we're playing D&D. Wow, man. That Skype phone call really killed my
bandwidth.
Yeah. No wonder why they were having a 4-second delay on the asterisk. Now we got a bit of a problem.
So what's the story?
I think some lines got crossed here, and we were supposed to. Our guest tonight would like us to do a test call with him.
Let's try it.
We're in the middle of the show.
Why not, man? Hasn't stopped us before.
I know.
But let's just bring them in, man, and get the show on the road.
If it works, hey, that's the test. No,
let's just get them on here, man.
Well, give them a ring.
Now, the problem with the sound device, is that you?
Here we go with this crap again.
Oh, man.
This is Ubuntu, isn't it?
I just want everybody to know that I'm here this week, and that's why you can hear us.
Yeah, just your presence.
What Dan breaks after that is beyond my control.
Wrong.
Sorry.
There.
There we go.
Mm-mm. Yeah, our lug. You missed the lug meeting, both of you. Alan wasn't even there last night.
I didn't miss it. I was sick, and I was in the middle of trying to get all the crap in my house back together.
Did you move?
No.
Are you moving?
No. All right, someday, I hope to be.
I'm waiting for Pat to finish his typing so we can start the Skype session. We're all waiting on Pat here now.
Go ahead.
You finished? Because we're a bunch of idiots. Burning.
Dan?
Brad?
Yes.
How does it sound to you?
Oh, no, the voice quality is good.
Excellent. You sound really good, too.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that I guess people weren't ready for prime time with the Asterisk bridge as far as bridging a high-frequency codec. I think that, well, a lot of people underestimated Skype's putting in of the global IP sound codec for high-quality voice is a really important thing.
Yes. I know you wanted to do a test call, but we're, like, right in the process of the show, so...
No, I understand. So we're ready to go.
Yeah, we're good.
We're already on. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to, before you say anything else, let you know that we are on.
Okay. Well, sorry. Yeah, I won't say my passwords then.
Good idea.
No, you can say those. That's fine. That's perfectly fine. So how you doing tonight?
We're good. We're good. Not as late here. I'm just coming up to 6 o'clock in California.
For anyone who doesn't know, we're speaking to Brad Templeton, who's the chairman of the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Welcome, Brad.
Good to be here.
What's the EFF?
Electronic Frontier Foundation.
That's right. The EFF is, I guess, now a 15-year-old organization devoted to doing civil rights work in the online world. Basically, as the world goes online and technologies change how things work, politicians and other forces tend to react pretty badly and without much knowledge to how technology is changing their world, and we hope to make things a little better as that happens.
So before we start launching into you with a bunch of questions and everything, was there a few words that you'd like to say in addition to your little intro there about the EFF before we start picking away at some issues that you guys causes that you've taken up recently?
Well, we do so many different issues. We've now grown from that beginning 15 years ago to a staff of about 25 people, a fair number of them lawyers. We're doing all sorts of issues in intellectual property. We're doing free speech, of course, from the very beginning, encryption rights, surveillance. We've been focusing now on trying to sue to stop the CALEA law that would put wiretapping on voice over IP phone calls, like the one we're doing now. We're trying to stop DRM systems from invading everything and forbidding the use of open source systems like Linux and multimedia and audio and video equipment, which seems to be what's happening, having tried to strike down the broadcast flag rule, for example. We've got a lot of things going on, so there's many things we can talk about. You have a chat room going here. I don't know if I should pay attention to it, but...
Absolutely.
Let's just fire
away. They'll shoot questions to you there as well.
Yeah, okay, and you know, if there's a question on the chat, we'll probably bring it up to you. So,
no problem.
I mean, we'll definitely make you aware of that. One of the things, a couple issues that we've been talking about for the past year or so, with regards to supporting Linux on the desktop, has been the issues with regards to DRM and audio and video codec support under Linux, and the difficulty, well, not so much the difficulty of getting that support, but the legality of the of using proprietary codecs.
Well, there's a legality question when it comes to proprietary. You mean patented codecs?
Yeah, patented codecs.
We've been concerned about laws simply forbidding Linux devices from even playing in the audio video space, and there was such a law. It was going to go into effect on July 1st of this year, which we and some other groups, particularly Public Knowledge in Washington, sued the FCC to have that law struck down. They were in Congress just 2 weeks ago trying to rewrite the law back into the statutes, and that's been slowed down for a while, but it's not over.
And it probably won't be over for a very long time, will it?
No, and then, you know, it's I try not to actually vilify my opponents and think they're evil. There are other people who do. I actually have a lot of sympathy. I've worked a lot in fact, basically, every dime that's put food in my mouth has come in some way from copyright or content industries, music. And my mother was a singer and my father was a novelist. And I, of course, built an online newspaper and have written software for most of my life. So I have a lot of, actually, sympathy and respect for the people who are trying to protect their copyrights. But the problem is they're justifiably worried and confused about how their old business models are falling apart as we move towards, of course, a big network with lots of bandwidth, lots of software, and lots of people who want to play things differently and don't necessarily want to obey their wishes or give them total control over the works that they publish. So we've got two forces going against each other, and these guys, they don't know what to do about it. So they look around, and they can't think of anything else to do to protect the way they used to make money. So they try and come up with this one, I guess obvious is the wrong word, but the only answer they can think of, which is to try and re-architect all the media technologies to lock down media. And the problem with that, of course, is, as most people in the open source community know, is that when you're giving everybody the source code to your software, and you're, as a matter of faith and license, requiring that they can modify that software as they wish, there's not really any practical way to produce lockdown systems. And if you can't produce lockdown systems, their philosophy is we won't let you play. We won't let you play any of the media from any of the major record labels and major movie studios. And that pretty much locks Linux out of the game.
And then you have people like Sony who install rootkits onto your computer.
Well, that's Nvidia. That's just last week. I mean, I think that one has to go for cojones. The idea that they would actually root. Now, not that rootkitting Windows is exactly a grand achievement. But
they did it anyway.
They did it anyway, and I mean, well, of course, the people in Windows don't really, of course, they don't have the term root, so they don't really know the term rootkit in the same way as people in the Unix and Linux world have used it for many years. But the we think Sony's just nuts on that one, and I can't say it's going to come back to haunt them. I think it's already haunting them.
They're getting sued in Italy.
Yeah, they're getting sued. I mean, it's just crazy that I guess all the people who did spywares and malwares and trickwares, whatever you want to call them, probably thought no one would notice or care. But I think by now they should have realized people would be worried about that. And anyway, putting that in is nuts, and I think they'll realize the error of their ways. Now, they haven't so far. I mean, the statements they've made have sort of said, hey, who cares about this? But I think they'll figure out that's not a good way to go.
Now, I mean, from my experience with the hell it's been with DRM technology and using multimedia devices, and looking at all the people I come into on a contact on a day-to-day basis, I mean, it's really, for me to play some of this content, the media, the audio on a Linux machine, or to be able to transfer files to a multimedia device, an MP3 player or an iPod, or even to play DVDs, is a bit of a hassle, and it's, in a sense, I'm breaking the law with doing it. But yet, you know, we say about open source opening the doors to illegal copying of this material. Yet at the same time, most of the people that I see copying this stuff illegally are using Windows or OS 10. I mean,
those still own the market, right? I mean,
right.
You're not going to be too surprised to see most of anything going on, unfortunately, in the in the Windows and Mac space, except maybe for innovation. This little dig. So the problem we're facing is not so much, I mean, computers are good at copying files, and that's what they're made for. Copying data is just one of those most primitive functions that's at the core of any computer system, and there's really no way to undo that. There's no way you can say, let's build a computer that's not very good at copying files. And as you say, when they build these systems, more often than not, they just create a lot of user trouble. They create incompatibilities. They make it harder for people to play the stuff, and they make it harder for people who are honest to be a customer. Now, I run some open source software called MythTV. I'm sure a lot of you people are familiar with it, and I have a couple of MythTV boxes in my house. And it's great, actually. I mean, I also have a TiVo, and I had the TiVo for many years before I moved to MythTV. And the truth is that the innovation in terms of video playing is actually going on in programs like MythTV. And that's because anybody, anywhere, can sit down there and think of a feature they want, and if they know how to code it, they can code it. And I've coded up a few new features for my own MythTV, put in system to do wish lists and suggestions and stuff like the TiVo has, and contributed that code out. It's available freely on my website. And there's thousands of other people doing exactly the same thing. And what that means is that even though only a tiny fraction of the public is using MythTV on Linux compared to how many people are going to use TiVo or Comcast Box, it's just that tiny fraction. But those tiny fractions are where the innovation is, the innovation that's going to spread out and move into the mainstream boxes of people who never heard of Linux. So when they shut down the Linux boxes and make certain things illegal, they're actually cutting out a lot more just the Linux user.
Yeah, MythTV is a great application. I've run it for quite a while. And it seems, though, that I'm waiting for the shoe to drop on them, you know, for somebody to try to sue MythTV and people who are using it. And go ahead.
I actually am not too scared of that. I think that, you know, there was a lawsuit. I mean, I can't say I'm totally unscared because there was a lawsuit against the Replay TV, which we got involved in, the EFF. Filed a countersuit on behalf of a variety of Replay TV owners. And the Replay VT owners said, you know, we don't want to be called thieves because we have our program that skips commercials. And there is a commercial skipper in MythTV, just as there was, and probably more advanced now than there was in the Replay TV. Now, the result of the Replay TV lawsuit was actually never decided because Replay went bankrupt. And it went bankrupt for more than just the lawsuit. I mean, the lawsuit certainly didn't help. They did go bankrupt, and so they settled the case, and that dismissed our countersuit, so we never did get a court ruling on that. But suing open source, totally open source projects, is a pretty hard thing to do. I mean, you got to figure if you're one of the companies trying to sue, what are you really out to do? There's nobody to sue that's got any money, for example. You're not going to get any damages and so on. And even if you do sue the coders who wrote one particular piece of code, there's 1,000 other coders. There is no one entity that you can go after. So it's a lot harder. And, you know, I think that's, for example, why BitTorrent has avoided lawsuit. And the other reason, BitTorrent and MythTV are perfectly legitimate technologies. I mean, they do things that everybody wants to do. Everybody wants a home video recorder like MythTV or like the TiVo. And BitTorrent is a really great tool, for example, for distributing a Linux distro. And I've downloaded more than a few Linux distros actually using BitTorrent. And these are great tools with totally legitimate purposes, and they know that those are protected. Now, they narrowed how much protection they had in the Supreme Court back earlier this year in the Grokster decision, and Grokster itself has caved in and shut down. But these tools, I think, are still pretty pure. Now, and it doesn't mean that they won't get other ideas in their minds and try and sue them, but so far I've got pretty good hope for MythTV.
Well, it's still it's just disheartening overall.
Well, no, there is a giant battle, and the battle's going on in music, and it's going on in video, and it's going on in TV. And even though we won the battle over the high-def tuner cards in the United States, in Europe there's a similar technology. It's called DVB, and of course, just... You remember amusingly for many years, most of the world used a video system called PAL, in contrast to the NTSC video system for analog TV that's used in the United States. And PAL is also analog TV, but it's designed a little later, a little more resolution, a little better color handling. And everyone thought it was really stupid there were these multiple systems, and when HDTV came along, it would be unified, but of course now there are two ways, at least, to broadcast HDTV. And in Europe, they're going to use the system called DVB, Digital Video Broadcasting. And there's a standards group that's been meeting for quite some time there. And while you might think the standards body would be like the IETF and be sitting down and trying to write down the protocols and what bit means what, they've spent a lot of their time, and we've been on the standards body, arguing indeed about a really complex copy protection regime that's going to be put into the standard. And then if the people who put in the standard get their way, passed into law in a variety of countries that says, once again, if you want to build a video recorder or a video tuning device, that it's got to respect these various bits that say what you can do with the file you record. And you can't give that file to equipment that hasn't done the right specs and been certified to obey the rules. So you get these locked up systems, and it would be not possible to build an open source system that can do everything you want it to do in for the European TV. And of course, once that happens, they'll come back to the United States and say, look, the U.S. had a law, it was struck down, but now it's all everyone else in the world is doing it, so let's write a new law. And that is indeed what we're afraid of.
I work for a school district, and there's a lot of there's a significant amount of press going out saying about school districts or educational institutions adopting Linux, using Linux on a desktop. And what
I'm not teaching evolution with it.
Yeah, that's it. But when I look at this and I say, how can we use it in our environment? It would be a great thing to use. One of the things that I come in having a problem with is being able to use online multimedia. They like to, they subscribe to certain services that provide educational videos, but you legally can't watch those under Linux because they're either delivered in Windows Media or QuickTime format. I mean, how can a school district get around that, or anybody get around that to be able to do that legally? It seems that we're in some sense, in an educational environment, blocking students or people from being able to access, you know, content.
Yeah, no, it is annoying. I mean, what's, on one hand, if you just have competing forces in the market, I sort of think that's, that's in the end good for us and the forces should fight each other out. But when things are incompatible deliberately rather than for a reason, that's obviously not good for anybody. So we've got Windows Media Player. Now, of course, as you know, a lot of the Linux and BSD tools like Xen and MPlayer and XMMS and all those other tools, they can play a remarkable number of the video formats in QuickTime and Windows Media Player, but they can't play them all, and they can't play the locked ones, and they can't play the locked ones without breaking their security, so in theory they cannot legally play them. And then patents are another question. So there's no easy answer to that other than to get more Linux in the schools so that the people who are selling stuff to the schools realize they're going to have to address the Linux market.
Now, one of the ways to address that is to use an open codec like Theora, AUG for audio. And it doesn't seem like a lot of the major players are willing to support that.
Well, I don't know if it's a willingness. I think most people, and I think every coder in the room can agree, sort of like once you got one thing working, you need a strong reason to do it again. And so if someone's coded up a system based on MP3, are they going to do the work to do Vorbis as well? And they're only going to do it if they see a big market reason to do it. If you can get them in the beginning and you can say, look, you're starting a new system, why don't you use an open system like AUG? Or frankly, even though there are patent issues, MP3 and the other codecs do have players for Linux. And it, in many cases, it's not hard to get software to do that. So I think the first battle is just to get them to go to at least one of the open standards instead of one of the proprietary ones. Getting them to go beyond the patented ones, that's yet another leap, and I sort of win this one step at a time.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, that's what we do. we don't just do this stuff, too. We've been talking about the media and intellectual property, but you'll in fact find that if you go to the EFF website and look at both the cases we're working on now and the history, some of these intellectual property cases have become some of the most famous, but there's a lot of else going on all over the web in terms of privacy and internet governance, free speech, censorship, encryption, surveillance, logging rights. We've been looking at biometrics. We've been looking at legalities of ISPs running wireless networks. We look at RFIDs. We look at spam. We look at the Patriot Act. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that we spend a lot of time on.
Now, a lot of these issues that we're talking about now and the topics that you're bringing up are really stuff that I hear circulating around the Internet, too, WWW2. That seems a hotbed for a lot of these issues. I mean, right off the bat, they're looking to lock it down. And just to play in that environment, you have to have some pretty... pretty powerful equipment to begin with. Do you see?
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm not personally on Internet too, so I haven't gotten to have the chance to live and breathe what's going on there in the same way. I mean, I know that, in fact, I guess there was some nice articles that came out this week about this question, that if the Internet were to arise today, they would try to ban it. I mean, I guess they did try and ban it in some ways when it was going, but it was a little easier to fight those bans because no one understood what it was. But there's no question that courts have already been banning the way the Internet grew. Even, for example, there's a story I tell, and they'll test the age of your audience. But I ask people to imagine a system that goes out and scans all the various sites on the Internet that have files and indexes all the files and makes a big search index that you can go and search in, and you can find a file, and it tells you various machines that have the file. And then it sets up a peer-to-peer connection between you and that machine to transfer the file to your machine. Right? Now, that kind of system has been under a lot of legal attack. And, in fact, in Australia, Kazaa has basically been banned for that. And a variety of other Napster was banned. But what I've actually described to you is a thing called Archie. And how many people out there remember what Archie was? It's the first Internet search engine. It's back in the early 80s. It's before the late 80s. It's before the World Wide Web. It was a search engine for FTP servers. And that, I consider Archie to be the grandfather of Google. So we've basically banned the path to Google. And that's something you want to be scared of. So what's happening, though, with Internet 2 is that some of the people who, by the way, just as we fight these bans, there's other people who want them. And those people look out and they say, oh, look, things are being redesigned. Well, we better get in and ban what we don't like in things that are being redesigned. And hopefully... people are smart enough to get their way around that. But I got to admit to not having studied the issues, particular issues in the Internet, too, that much.
So what do you think for our listeners right now, what do you think would be big topics that the EFF is focusing on and targeting? What is it that we should be aware of, and how can we help out?
Well, I mean, I think you should be aware of the new CALEA interpretation that's just come from the FCC. CALEA stands for Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act. It's a law that, when it was written in the early 90s, was designed to require the telephone companies, when they were moving to digital switching from the old-style switches they used to have long ago, to basically build into the software wiretapping so that the police could come up and say, listen, we've got a wiretap order, and we've got this international criminal Don Washko, and we want to tap him. And in the old days, they used to go and they'd say, okay, here's the wire running to his house, and the police could put alligator clips on it, and they could listen to the calls. But of course, as they moved to digital telephony, that wasn't possible anymore. So the police lobbied for a law that would say that the software that would do the digital phone switching would have features so you could get a console and say, we want to now listen to the calls in this person, this number. So that's how they began it. And when the law was drafted, we were actually there, and we actually made some compromises we now regret on the passing of the law. But one of the things that we were given for our compromises was a rule that this would not apply to the Internet, because we thought it was pretty important to keep it off the Internet, and we sort of sacrificed, probably incorrectly, what was going on in the among the big telephone companies and figured they could fend for themselves. And now the FCC has rewritten that, and the Voice over IP is taking off, and so they're starting to say, we want to apply those principles to the Internet. We want people who design Internet systems and ISPs and routers and stuff like that, they should code up wiretapping built in. And in particular, they're focusing on the voice over IP, companies like Vonage, companies maybe eventually like Skype, although Skype so far has escaped this. But all the companies that are providing voice over IP, and by the way, today the rule they make is that if a company lets you make calls in and out of the regular phone system, which a company like Vonage does do, and actually Skype does do, that then you're like a phone, and because you're like a phone, you quack like a phone, we're going to regulate you like a phone. And we're going to have the power to require the wiretaps, and we're going to have the power to require you to have 911, 911, I mean, working. And they put in all these regulations. But the rules is actually say that even if it isn't talking to the phone system, if it's become a replacement for the phone system, then they get to regulate it. And so basically they're saying what they don't understand is on the Internet, voice and phone calls are just another application. They're just another type of bits. They're another type of packets. And the Internet is not architected at certain levels that you're supposed to pay a lot of attention to the particular application, that the routers are supposed to know what the application is and try and fuddle with it. It's just not a good idea. It's not the way the Internet is designed to work. And there are reasons why it's not the way the Internet is designed to work. So if they put these regulations in, as they are trying to do, or as they, in fact, have claimed they've done, you get a requirement that everybody who's coding up systems that today do voice, but in the future do even more, they have to look up the laws, and they have to put in the wiretapping code, and they have to make sure they're conforming to all this. And by the way, that means you've got to have a legal department. So if you are SBC, or if you are even Vonage, a venture capitalist-funded company, you have a legal department, and you pay them money, and you get this stuff done. And even though the numbers that are out there sound scary from a financial standpoint, because it's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars in many cases to get this done, that's just a small change in Wall Street. But if you're a small, innovative developer, if you're an open-source developer, or you're a little small entrepreneur sitting in a garage, if you're like two guys in a garage in Estonia, well, that wouldn't apply because this is an American law, but if you're two guys in a garage in Peoria trying to build Skype or trying to build a new revolution that's going to change the way the phone works, suddenly you have to have a legal department, and you have to do all this wiretapping. So that's thing number one that's wrong with it, which is it's going to stifle a lot of innovation. By the way, the big companies love that because the big companies want it to be hard for little guys to come in and compete with them. You know, in fact, I often say in my speeches that if you are a big incumbent phone company like SBC or Verizon or one of these other companies, then you should love these rules because they do make it hard for the little guy to compete and innovate. So that's problem number one. Now, problem number two is, of course, they make it easier for people to wiretap you. And, no, I'm not going to say that if you're a terrorist and they have a warrant out on you to wiretap you, that they shouldn't be able to do what they can to wiretap you. But they also wiretap people inappropriately, and there's lots of evidence of that going on. Happens all the time, especially with this new Patriot Act rules. And they're just making it easier. And secondly, when you design wiretapping into a system, it's like you're putting in a deliberate security hole. I call it a security window, by the way. Some people do like to say hole or vulnerability. I think we should call it a window, so I found a window into your software. Sounds just the same as a hole, but I leave the plural as an exercise to the audience. That's supposed to get a laugh. I guess it doesn't anymore.
On the draw here. That's
crickets.
Yeah, exactly. So if you leave a deliberate security window into the software, that doesn't sound like very good security design. I mean, a system like Skype encrypts end-to-end, at least they tell us it does. Of course, there's some fair criticism of the fact that they have not publicized how their encryption works. But when you have a system like that that's designed to encrypt end-to-end, can't be wiretapped, if you put a deliberate backdoor to turn it off, that just sounds risky to me. That's not how a good security engineer would design a system. We really don't want the government to architect how our systems work. There's so many costs to that. So that's a big issue that I think a lot of people should be concerned about, because voice IP and voice applications that go beyond just a phone call that do other things. I'm doing some coding in that area myself, so I'm worried about it for my own personal reasons as well as with my EFF hat on.
I think one of the reasons that I'm worried about that kind of thing is if they put a window in for the government to be able to tap our phone conversations, that same window can be exploited by other people as well.
Well, exactly. I mean, obviously, they'll claim that everyone will code it all perfectly, and so there won't be these problems. But
sure,
we know how it really happens.
Well, if there's, you know, if there's any way to exploit that kind of thing, someone will find a way.
Yeah.
And just leaving it open is bad altogether.
So, I mean, another area that we've been working on a lot is reverse engineering. We haven't had as much success there as we'd like to of late, but we believe that the reverse engineering is a pretty important technical principle, that the ability to reverse engineer products is pretty good for innovation. I mean, it's true that you don't like reverse engineering when someone else is reverse engineering your secret thing, but the public seems to benefit if engineers can go out, take things apart, see how they work, and make them better. Unfortunately, there's a whole bunch of legal stuff going on that's trying to ban that. And we recently did defend a company called BNetD. BNetD reverse engineered the protocol that's used in the Blizzard games. You know, I'm sure many people play these Blizzard games like Warcraft and so on. And they reverse engineered the protocol and built their own server so that you could play on their server instead of on the Blizzard server, and of course without paying the Blizzard server money. Blizzard got particularly upset as well because some of the stuff they had put in to look for illicit copies of their games was not in the reverse engineered server. That's probably what made them the most upset. But the basic principle of reverse engineering the server is one that should have been able to defend, and unfortunately so far I have not had success in the court with that.
Changing gears, Apple is selling lots of music online. They're getting into video now. They've claimed that they've sold over 1 million downloads of video. What are they charging? $2 a video? $1 a video?
$1.99.
It's 99 cents, I thought. Isn't it? Is it $1.99 for some video?
I thought the TV was $1.99.
Right.
Something.
They're totally in with the DRM, and they're in bed with Hollywood, obviously.
For sure.
DRM, it seems not to be going away. I guess the question is, which format of DRM are we going to be stuck with?
Well... that's not a question you'll get an answer to from me.
Maybe we could speculate, though.
I don't have an iPod. I've got a Rio Karma, which plays OGG files and plays MP3s. And it plays WMAs, too, I think, but it doesn't. I think that's the only DRM format it does. But the music I have on it is all OGGs and MP3s. When I rip my CDs, I usually do rip them to OGGs. I've stayed away from the iPod. I can't deny the iPod's a cool product. It's nicely designed, good user interface, and a variety of other things about it. I actually think that I'm surprised at the price of the video. I think it should be even cheaper. I've written a fair bit about how bad a deal actually commercial TV is.
Yeah, I read your blog post.
Yeah, I read that. Well, I've written about that a couple of years ago, and I've been writing it again because we're seeing this market develop, but for those who haven't had a chance to read that, turns out that when they run a TV ad, they tend to charge the advertiser about a penny per person who's watching it. So that if you watch an hour of TV, there's typically about 30 ads in that. That's about 15 minutes. It varies based on the program how many ads are in it. But assuming there's 30 ads in it, that means they get about 30 cents to every person who watches it. Now, that's wholesale, so I won't say that it shouldn't go up, but I think that's a pretty rotten deal, actually, in the sense that if you watch 4 hours of TV and then you're going to watch an hour of advertising in that 4 hours of TV, so for an hour of your time staring at the ads, they get $1.20, and so in theory you're getting $1.20 worth of programming, or at least programming that was created for actually less than $1.20, because, of course, there's distributors and markup and everything else in there. So, that's not a very good deal, $1.20 an hour. That would be an illegal wage in most countries. And I've never been fond of that deal. And I'm a bit surprised, actually, that they want to – I mean, I'm not surprised they want to charge more, but I think we could get our TV delivered to us over the Internet, forget about broadcast TV, and get it at a price that's the same price that they're selling it for today. You know what I mean? I would rather pay 30 cents an hour for my television rather than – watch 30 ads, but so far they're going to actually not give me that opportunity. I'd like to see the internet television be better in every way than the stuff I get in my TV. I mean, I won't watch TV without my TV or Myth TV box today, and I bet you a lot of people are like that. So, Anyway, but I mean, the video iPod looks cool. I mean, as to what DRM, I'm not sure any DRM that's today will win, because first of all, they haven't really clued into the fact that DRM doesn't work. At least it doesn't work for stopping your stuff from getting out, because all it takes is one person to crack it, and whether that person's good or evil, I'll leave for another judgment, but if one person cracks it, then it can be on the net, and then everyone can get a copy of it because they've removed the DRM from it. So DRM really only gets in the way of the honest people who just want to do some honest things and perhaps a few what you'll call mildly infringing things, you know, like letting a friend have a copy of an album. You can argue that's a copyright violation. The truth is, though, it never really hurt the business that much. And what hurts the business is if one person shares an album with a million of their closest friends. That's the thing that they've been most scared of. And I don't think it's bad for them to sue someone who does share an album with a million of their closest friends. But when they try and shut down just ordinary use, that's when they get in the way of innovation, get away of the customer, and that's a concern. So none of the DRMs we have today will be the winner. You could be right that, one, there will be a dominant DRM for many years to come. But the ones today will be broken. I'm pretty confident about that. They'll have to be revised and refined. You know, Microsoft will try and own all the Microsoft's taken at first a fairly pro-DRM stance, but they've actually softened a little bit of late. So I rarely say bless their hearts to Microsoft, but, hopefully they'll change their minds about that.
I tell people that they should support independent sites like Magnatune, where there is no DRM. And if they are going to buy music from, say, iTunes, you use an application like Sharp Music, which strips off the DRM when they download the song.
Well, I mean, they can do that. I mean, I guess I do feel, however, that the people do want the music from the big labels, and they want movies from the big studios. And not entirely, by the way. I mean, a lot of people are correctly advocates of the long tail idea that there's plenty of stuff that's not a big hit that's worth going after. But at the same time, you can't really tell people only look at that stuff from the secondary markets that isn't a big hit, that isn't from the big labels. I mean, you want both is the real answer. So you won't be able to sell video and audio players that can only play independent music. I mean, it sounds nice, but I don't see that happening.
So you're a realist, Brad.
Well, yeah. I mean, I mean, that's their whole thesis, right? They have a monopoly of sorts. They don't have as strong a monopoly as they used to have. I mean, it used to be, you know, if you go to a record store, there's basically nothing but big label music. And if you go into a movie store, there's certainly nothing, or a movie theater, there's nothing but big movie studio movies. And the Internet has changed that, because now you can get a lot of stuff that's not from the big companies. And that's great, because you want to have a lot of choice. You want to have a lot of variety. But that doesn't mean the big companies aren't there, and it doesn't mean people don't want their stuff, and it doesn't mean they can't even produce good stuff. I've enjoyed quite a lot of, you know, Hollywood blockbuster movies that cost a lot of money to produce. I don't think it would be bad if they could still produce them, and I could still watch them.
So with issues like Kalia and all the other stuff, what can we do to help?
Well, I mean, there's a couple things you can do. I mean, we have an email newsletter that we put out, and we have action alerts where we describe specific legal issues that people should be aware of, and then they can decide if they would like to contact politicians. We even have a little thing on our action alert site that will help you send an email or fax to your representative if you're an American. So, you know, you can make your views known. You can make your views known to the companies and by what you buy. And well, I was going to say it's not really that effective to say let's just boycott big motion picture association movies. You can, however, make choices in equipment. You know, you can decide instead of buying the iPod that you want to buy a different player that isn't locked up the way the iPod is. They are also pretty expensive, so it's not that hard a decision to make. Secondly, I mean, you can go out and you can write code and you can try and change the world that way. And of course, I'm going to say thirdly that if you do believe you have a duty to make a difference in this area and you don't have time to do it yourself, you just outsource that work. And we will outsource it for you. Just come by and join us. Become a member at, you know, we'll take any donation, of course, the bigger the better. But give us a donation, and we will definitely put that work, that money to work on these causes. So that is the simplest way, and it sounds greedy of me to say just give us money, but the truth is that is the simplest way for you to make a difference in this area. A lot of people together pooling their money can really make a difference. We haven't won every case. We've lost cases, but usually when we lose them, it's when we had a hard fight and we got a lot of messages out, and of course a lot of time we win cases and we really change the world. So that's the best technique.
So what kind of do you have any current cases that you're working right now? What kind of current cases are you looking at?
Well, actually, a lot of the cases I've just been talking about over the last half hour have been been current cases that we've been doing. I mean, as I mentioned, we've been in the Supreme Court this year. If you go to EFF.org, actually, and we're also we have two blogs on the EFF website. One's called the Deep Links blog and the Mini Links blog, which will tell you, as well as the main news RSS feed that will let you track about. So anyway, we've got this case going on about the Kalia. We've joined with a bunch of other groups to try and stop that. We're on the DVB standards body. I just told you about that. We've been defending a whole bunch of people who get sued for postings they make on message boards under anonymous IDs. And so, for example, in these cases, the way it works is someone posts something on Yahoo or some other message board and they have an ID, and someone doesn't like it, so they sue about it. And so they don't know who it is who posted it, so they sue the anonymous person. Now, the people filing the lawsuit, the way they want the law to work is they want the mere act of suing, rather than actually demonstrating someone did anything wrong, to let them unmask the identity. And that kind of makes the identities useless, because you just sue, unmask, and then drop the case. And this has actually happened in a few cases. So when that happens, we try and go in. Well, right, but we, in fact, sat there. Verizon and some other companies also did a lot of work in this area to lay down them. No, that's not how it works. You know, you do get to find out who they are if they actually did wrong. But you have to go in and convince the court that they did some wrong, or there's, you know, an extremely high probability that there's wrong there. And then you might be able to unmask them and then get them to give you the money that they owe you from the court. But we believe anonymous speech is a pretty important right that this country was founded on. We think it's worth defending. And, in fact, we're doing non-legal effort in that area as well. We have been funding, although of late we've been running out of money on it, and so we definitely could use donations. But we've been funding the piece of software called Tor. It's an open-source software project. You can see it at tor.eff.org. And we recommend you actually all download it and compile it or install it. Run a node if you can. What Tor does is all the people who run Tor nodes become a cloud. And when I want to go to a web page, for example, my browser goes through the Tor server, and that goes out and picks a random other node out there to send the packets to. And then that one picks another random one, and that one picks another random one. And after a few hops, not too many because it gets too slow, but just a small number of hops, it goes back out into the public web, and it goes to the website. And that guarantees, pretty close to guarantees, that your web surfing is anonymous and cannot be traced back to you. We don't allow mail through because of the spam right now, but for web surfing and a variety of other purposes, it's the could be the only way, and in fact in certain countries it's definitely about the only way, to surf and act on the web anonymously. So we need more people to run servers, and we also need more money for that, so we're very keen to see that. Now, we're also in the courts, however, trying to defend anonymity, but we're afraid, actually. We see a lot of people out there trying to shut down anonymity. We even see some of our friends, by the way, trying to shut it down. The anti-spam community, and we hate spam as much as anyone else, but we have come to odds with some people in the anti-spam community because we don't want to destroy a lot of important fundamental principles just to stop spam. And even though we hate spam, we think there's other ways to stop it besides forcing everyone to provide ID in order to send mail, which is what some people propose, and all in shutting down anonymity in general, which is what some other people have proposed. So it's not an easy battle, especially when you get into battles with people who would normally be your friends.
All important issues that people need to be aware of. And we really support what you guys are doing. And you fight the good fight. It seems, though, that, like, politicians, it seems that it's not so much, you know, on different sides of the aisle, you know, who are opposed or for this. It seems that, you know, the RIA and the NPAA, they have their, you know, their hands in politicians on both sides' pockets, you know?
They do. Unfortunately, the senators from California, who you'd hope would be representing Silicon Valley, seem to feel it's more important right now, at least, to represent Hollywood. Of course, both are in California, which makes it hard for them to maybe come to a decision. But we'd like them to actually just represent the people. That would be even better than either of those choices.
You guys are doing fantastic work, and we really appreciate it. And we do, you know, suggest people donate to the EFF.
Well, we can certainly use it. I mean, as I say, we do have that staff, 25 people. It takes quite a bit of money to keep it running. And we get almost all that money, actually, from private donations and membership. We get a small percentage from foundation grants, which is different from most other nonprofits. And we really don't get any corporate money. We get small amounts of corporate money, but it really doesn't affect things that much. And I'm surprised, actually, the corporations aren't willing to give us more money, because there are definitely corporations that our work has helped a great deal. I mean, for example, we spent close to 8 years on a lawsuit defending the right to export encryption, using the thesis, by the way, a good thesis, that source code was protected speech. You know, that source code is not just a program. Source code is a way for programmers to communicate with other programmers and to talk about code. And so we put that before the courts, and they did agree with that, actually. And we were able to strike down the rules. And many of you will remember that in the old days, that when you downloaded a web browser or operating system or any other tools, quite often it would come with no encryption or with really sucky encryption. And you had to go and go to a special site where you'd swear you were an American or prove you were an American, and then you could download the real encryption. And the reality of that was that nobody did it, and so the encryption didn't get deployed. And it was basically a bad situation, and we had a long lawsuit about that. And anyway, so once we won that lawsuit, a lot of businesses suddenly were freed from regulation, and they were made a lot easier for them to incorporate encryption in their products, especially encryption companies, of course. And as you know, now when you download stuff, it comes with secure encryption, and that's great. But you'd think those companies would have thanked us for all the money we saved them, but they didn't too much. I mean, a few did a little bit, but definitely not the way I would have expected.
Outstanding.
I hope that that everybody at least get a chance to look at our website and subscribe to our newsletter if they're interested in these issues or any of the blogs. And, of course, if they can give us some money, we'd be very happy. As I like to say, you know, at the $65 level, we'll give you free speech, and at the $120 level, we'll also throw in privacy rights. The truth is, however, if you don't give any money, we'll still fight for your free speech. You can just feel guilty about it.
Changing gears, Brad, I see that you started one of the most widely read news groups, RecHumor.Funny.
Yeah, I know. Of course, in the old days, Usenet was the sort of soul of the Internet before the web came along. And back, how long ago is that now? Almost 20 years, 18 years ago, started RecHumor.Funny as an experiment with a moderated news group that was more of a publication, edited thing. That's, of course, very common today. There's a million blogs and other such things that are similar. Did that for a long time, and then I passed, I still host it and host the website and manage all the software and stuff, but I've had other people do the editing and picking up the jokes. Jim Griffith is the guy who does it today. Still going, still got lots of jokes going out there, which is one of my many loves. But that was fun, and indeed, when Usenet was the sole Internet, RecHumor.Funny was the most widely read thing on Usenet by quite a good margin, actually. And the result is it probably was the most widely read thing on the Internet until Yahoo came along.
I was looking through your bio, and one of the things you had mentioned was the question is, did I originate .dot, meaning the whole .dot top-level domain name convention that's being used on the Internet? Did you really come up with that?
Well, come up with it's too strong a word. I mean, it's a somewhat facetious claim. I mean, there's some literal truth to it, but it's just a question of being on the right place at the right time. There was, of course, in the very earliest days of the ARPANET, not everyone knows this actually, but there was just one level domains, and so you just send email to someone, and I was, what was my address back then? p-btemple@mit-multics. You know, that would be an ARPANET email address. And so everyone knew that we needed to have another level to the hierarchy, and actually to my hindsight surprise, at first we were only talking about doing two levels, and when obviously N is the right answer, as we do have. And the real father of a lot of these syntaxes and protocols, John Postel, is now dead, but John wrote a lot of those early drafts, and he wrote up a draft for doing two levels, and his proposal was the reverse of how we do it today. He said, let's say user.domain@com. Now, the reason, the logic behind that was that all the software was sort of today was taking the at sign, in an email address at least, and parsing the right-hand side as where it should go send the mail. And the theory was if you said user.domain@com, the system, the old system would find the com server, and the com server would be responsible for understanding what was on the left and splitting it up on the dot. So I simply wrote a message to the mailing list saying, I think it reads a lot better as user@domain.com, and we should really reverse the order of that. And there was really no discussion of it, you know, and it is what happened in the end. I have no idea if it's because I said that or if it's just other people came to the same realization. So that lets me make this not entirely serious claim of being the father of the dot.
What do you use to put your panoramic photos together?
Well, I've been doing, I've got a couple different software packages I like to use, and the first one I use a lot is one called PhotoVista, which has gone through many owners. It was originally done by Live Picture, and I think it was originally one of the guys who built the original QuickTime Stitcher. And then it was acquired by, I can't remember who, and now it's run by another company called IC Media. It hasn't improved a lot over time, though, which is my main complaint about it. The other package I like a lot is called Panorama Factory, and that's been through a lot more development. So PhotoVista is a lot easier to use. It's a sort of if it can do your panorama, it's very quick and doesn't take that much memory. And basically, you fire in your pictures, and you can stitch it up, and then you can make a few improvements here and there. Panorama Factory is a lot more complex to use, and it takes a lot more memory, but it now has, it's refined a lot so that it has got a lot of fancy features for a difficult panorama. So if the panorama is particularly difficult, I used to go to Panorama Factory, and if it was easy and also very large because of the memory requirements, I would use PhotoVista. PhotoVista also had a very, very different algorithm for blending two photographs together, which was quite clever and actually worked best on photos where there were things moving in the picture, like people or cars, which is true of a lot of pictures. And the other programs, basically all the other programs, were not very good at that. But now Panorama Factory has got an ability to do the same kind of blending that you can handle those pictures. So I may end up moving more to it, but for now I still use them both.
And what OSs do they run on?
Oh, that's the bad sign. Yeah, there's... the only tools that run for that run on Linux tend to be pretty hard to use, and so yeah, they run on those proprietary operating systems. I actually have, well, even then it's not enough, but I do have a system I like called WinForLin that lets me run Windows in a box under Linux.
Right.
And they have the old, oddly enough, their old version, which runs Windows 98 in a box, is great. And their new one, the Pro one as they call it, which runs Windows XP in a box, sucks. Because it's more of an emulator, and so it's really slow. But it does run Windows XP, as opposed to the other one, which is implementing a lot of the underlying features in Linux. Some of these programs, like Photoshop, I run Photoshop under Wine, and that works. And I also run, I've run Panorama Factory under Wine, but, I haven't got Panorama Factory to run under Wine yet. No, the Panorama programs I can't get to run under Wine yet. In fact, I can't even get them to run fully under WinForLin all the time. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. So, even though I had, in fact, my Windows machine that I had, it died in December, and I hadn't actually booted it, and I just booted it up this month because I needed to build some new panoramas, so I'm afraid that's the bad news. As I often ask people at Linux, even at Linux conferences, you know, how many people run Windows, and very few people put their hands up, and I'll say, how many people have a Windows machine, and unfortunately, most people put their hands up.
You got to get people, convince people to create the panoramic software under Linux, too.
Yeah, and in fact, I've talked to the people about, or, you know, at least getting it to run under Wine.
Uh-huh.
You know, if they're not ready to do all the development to code it for Linux. And, well, you know, there's two things that stand in the way. One is, of course, that Linux desktops are just a few percent of the market. And, hey, I've been a software developer, and I am a software developer and in the commercial market, and, you know, there are commercial realizations you have to go through for that. And the other thing, which it's both a blessing and a curse, but people on Linux sort of expect this offer for free. So they're not, even if they were an even share of the market, I'm wondering if they'd be as commercially viable to the people who are trying to make their living selling the software. You know, obviously they're not people running the way Richard Stallman would like them to run their lives, but that's fine. So we're phoning somebody.
Somebody's messing with
Link
something.
Link is playing around with his newly configured Slackware install.
Yeah.
We need a GIMP plugin for this.
So you're still running Slackware?
Oh, yeah.
We run a bunch of things, Debian too.
I haven't looked at that for a long, long time. Of course, I used to share office space with a guy who, his company was called Yggdrasil, and he was one of the very first Linux distros and competed with Slackware at that time. And he went away. It didn't totally go away, and obviously, one of the great missed opportunities, because after that, you know, some companies made a lot of money doing Linux distros, although, of course, some also failed. But I have not looked at Slackware in a long time. It's kind of hard to choose what distribution you're going to run. I think that, you know, part of me has become lazy in my old age, and I sort of think, if I can't apt get it, I'm not going to run it. And that's kind of sad, but that's sometimes the way it is.
Well, you know, you can do that on Slackware, too. They have Slapgit.
Well, no. I mean, so that's, you know, that's important that you have. But what I'm saying is that the old-style idea that I'm just going to, you know, download the source and compile it and install it, I do that from time to time. But the truth is it just becomes a bigger and bigger system administration nightmare the more you do it. And that's one of the problems, the challenges, I think, that sits in front of me. I mean, one of the answers people have had to that is packages and binary distributions and so on. I have a philosophy I'm pitching that I think I want to see operating systems, and I mean every Linux distro, and this would apply to Windows too, organized not just according to what they are, like, you know, you have a directory for one program and a directory for another program, but by who. And that's the saying that you have a file tree that's for the sysadmin, and one that's for the company admin, and one that's for the packager, and everybody divide up their changes to a system in a compartmentalized way. It doesn't have to be the file trees. It could be a version control system or something else, so that we can isolate what I change about the system versus what other people change. And right now we don't isolate that, and that makes it hard to upgrade a system if you've hand-installed and hand-configured a lot of software. And the truth is, you know, maybe when I was younger I was happy to sysadmin all day, but I'm not anymore.
I'm lazy, too. I like apt-get.
Sure. And who doesn't? Right? I mean, even, you know, I ran Gentoo for a while. And
I thought you said you were lazy.
It's always compiling.
I was sharing a machine with some friends, and we ran Gentoo. And, you know, it was actually kind of scary to build everything every time. Because it sure seemed like, I mean, it actually works decently well, but there were ways to get things really screwed up in a way that were hard to undo without a bit of research.
Well, one distro I'm looking forward to checking out is Arch Linux. It seems that it's a mixture of like Slackware and Debian, and Gentoo kind of in the middle. That's one I want to check out myself.
I haven't looked. I mean, I'm actually right now mostly running Fedora, and I've got Debian as well. But, you know, it's, one of the reasons you run Fedora, even if you don't necessarily like it as your favorite distro, is simply because you know that people make RPMs for it in advance of other systems. And, I mean, Debian's up there, too. People are making Debs a lot more now. And, you know, you just know you're going to have less system administration hassle if someone else has done the work for you.
Yeah, I was running Fedora with my Myth TV box using Jared Wilson's how-to, and that ran pretty well. I didn't have any really problems with that.
Yeah, my Myth TV is running on Fedora. I mean, actually, a lot of the Myth TV developers are running Debian, so I feel pretty confident running it on top of Debian, too. But I would not really... I mean, Myth TV is still young enough that there's a fair bit of work in getting it going right. And I would not recommend, unless you really love another distro, to start running that on some of those distros. I mean, people have even ported it to the BSDs and stuff. And if you're at home in a particular operating system, then I can see using it. But other than that, I got to say I've got too much other stuff to do than to fix systems.
Brad, we want to thank you for taking the time and talking to us. You've talked about a lot of important issues that people need to be aware of, and we recommend people donating to the EFF. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much, and have fun and keep up your show, and I'll try and change the world one person at a time.
Thanks.
All right.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Thanks a lot, Brad.
Oh, wait. Good interview.
Lost where I was.
Very good interview.
Where did you lose?
I don't know what I did.
A lot of important issues, man. So, Link, how's that new install of Slackware going with XFCE?
Looks pretty good, except for I really need to do my network drivers better.
It's just looking over your shoulder, it just looks so much more responsive than Ubuntu with GNOME.
Oh, hell yes. Look at that.
Honestly, that's a fairly old system, 400 megahertz, right?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah. Fairly old? No, it's ass old.
It's crusty.
You are currently the only person in that conference.
Alan's gone.
Look at that. Like
Alan's not in
I still have all my swap space left and two more megs of RAM than I had on Ubuntu, and I'm actually running stuff. So. Oh, yeah.
You know, all your problems go away if you just run Canonics.
That's what I hear.
Canonics rules, man.
That's what I hear. Some little birdie keeps saying that shit over my shoulder.
Some of the listeners, they sent me an email regarding another DVD backup application, K9 Copy. I gave that a whirl, man, and it's fantastic. I love it. It's similar to what DVD Shrink was in Windows. You can open up a disk. You can choose to just pull off the main movie.
You know what? Not to cut you off, but we got 30 seconds left on BinRev.
Good night, BinRev.
So you can say your goodbyes and goodnights to the BinRev crowd now. So they don't get before they just get cut off without ever saying goodbye and goodnight.
Bye-bye.
But go ahead now.
Okay, K9 Copy. It's a fantastic program. It's very similar to DVD Shrink in Windows. You open up the disk. You can copy the whole movie with all the menus intact, and it'll re-encode it. And or you could just take off the main movie and just keep one audio track, or you can pick and choose what you want to keep. You know, alternate audio tracks, subtitles, whatever you want. And it's even nice if you have K3B installed on your system. It'll fire up K3B automatically, and you can burn it to a DVD ISO, or you can burn it to a disc.
Alan!
It's great. Alan's back?
Hey!
You
don't sound sick!
Hey, I've been here the entire time. You guys blew me off before the show.
We didn't blow you off, man.
Yes, you did.
No way.
Yeah, it's like, I got to go talk to somebody else, and he hangs up on me.
Well, that's that whole Skype thing where you have to hang up and conference everybody in and all that crap.
Yeah, but I take it I don't show up on Skype because I've been on Skype since, like, you guys called the guest. And I guess I don't show up on there.
Did he show up? I didn't even look, man.
I don't recall you showing up as being available. You know what? The only people that show up as being available are two people at the top, and I don't know how they do it. They're always available when I log in.
I've got it over here, and like nobody shows up at all.
Right.
Is it a Windows people that show up available? I don't know. Maybe there's something wrong with the Linux Skype client. I don't know.
I think that's what it is, because on Linux I've never seen anybody available. I can't even get to you guys on it. Like I put your name in there, and it tells me it can't even find you guys.
sucks.
We just need we need one more computer in here so we can do a Skype and an asterisk at the same time. But then we wouldn't have enough outputs.
No, we would need a bigger mixer.
Alan, buy us a bigger mixer.
More lines.
More mixers, more stuff, man.
Actually, you do need the other computer because I can actually mic in another line in there.
You can or can't?
Can't.
I can. Actually.
Where the hell are you going to put another line?
Some of the inputs, well, some of the other inputs also you can put mics in as well. You can, not excuse me, not mics, as well as lines. And you can vary the volume between them.
I see. Well, not just that, but like, you know, between Alan and I, we have, what, 5 mixers or something like that?
Yeah. We
so if we, like, strung them together, if we strung them together, man, we could get some serious shit going on in here. But
we got about 20 channels if we really work on it.
We
got
to come in here and build, like, a wall shelving unit for Dan or something to hold all the computers he's going
to
need.
And, you know, and we need to put a triple lock on the door to keep the dog from pissing on the modem. And the little hands from twisting the knobs.
No more peeing on the DSL modem, damn it.
It's off the area where she can get to.
Well, I'm looking for a box. I want to pick up a box to put the, you know, one of those little 19-inch boxes, the racks, that, you know, for, like, the traveling.
Yeah.
On it, so you can put the... Put the compressor in there, and on top of it, we can put the mixer. And that way, when we're done, you put the top on it, and no little fingers touch it.
Yep, that'll work too.
Although that's never been a problem. Actually, we've been exactly the same. I don't. You know, the problem
I don't,
we had last week, I have no clue what happened with that.
I wasn't here. I'm telling you, that's what
it
happens every time.
I thought the show sounded good. When I was listening to the feed, it was okay, but the recording just came out terrible.
Was both of them?
It was very low.
Which one?
We almost had an hour and a half of dead air.
Because I didn't listen to the MP3 because I figured that was fine as compared to...
No, that wasn't.
I listened to the MP3 that I built the same off the wave that I built the AUG from, and that was really low. I mean, I even boosted that up. I don't know what went on.
Got put up.
What?
That must have been the version that got put up because I had it cranked up and I had everything on 10. I couldn't even hear it.
No. That MP3 came from the Dynabolic, the same we do every week. Because the MP3 from the Wave is named differently. So you can't get that.
We got to, like, shake the chicken leg or something there and... The voodoo stuff to get going and make sure that doesn't happen again.
Yeah, but what doesn't make sense is this week.
Wave the magic.
This week we have the complete opposite. We're too loud.
No, I don't actually think. I've been listening to the stream the entire time on it, and I thought it was all very well.
Good.
So I don't think you're too
loud. I think Dan's just too loud because he keeps cranking his freaking headphone volume up, man.
Well, as long as nobody swallows a mic, we're okay.
Long as that.
What's all going on?
Last week I also had the problem of being too far away from the mic.
It's right. We need to get one of those, you know, those little clip-on microphones that they use on guitars. We're going to hook that on the side of Dan's lip so that he can't turn away from the mic and not talk into it.
No, what I got to get is one of those spit screens.
Yeah.
you hook them up and everybody stays 6 inches away from the mic.
Yep.
It's good because it'll keep the mic from getting really smelly.
Where are you sticking your mic, boy?
You laugh, man.
They'll smell like beer or farts.
If you've ever been
anyway.
In a band, sometimes they'll go to like a rehearsal studio and they'll have like mics up there, man. You're up there and you're singing.
Oh, yeah,
you smell the freaking mic, man. It is the most rancid goddamn smell you've ever smelled. From people spitting and drooling on the microphones.
Mmm.
Tasty. Do you lick it then, too, just to see, you know, the flavor?
Mmm. Is that Dan? Yes, it is. It tastes like
Dan
to me. Wait a minute. One more lick. Mmm. How many licks does it take to get to a center of a microphone? One, two.
That's pretty much Dan's ass.
Yeah, that's a problem. That's a problem. Dan's microphone smells like a fart. Figure that one out. Huh? That's a problem. You know, mine smells like a cigar. Pat smells like a beer. Dan smells like ass. There's a problem there somewhere.
Last week we had that question about what hard drive to go with. Remember that question?
Yeah.
What was your answer, Link?
My answer would have been a serial ATA for now. Really. If you know, just for like cost's sake, and they're getting really fast, you know, really big, really fast serial ATA drives. If you're going to run a server, and you absolutely has to be like a mission-critical thing, and it has to be dead reliable forever and ever, go SCSI. Other than that, use serial ATA. If you really don't give a shit, and you just have a couple of bucks and you want to get something, buy BIDE.
Yeah, serial, you know? Serial ATA is the new ID, right?
It is, but it's faster, and it's a lot more reliable, and I think like robust handling than IDE is. IDE has always had its little flaky problems here and there. But if you're just making a crap box somewhere, I've been running IDE for a long, long time and haven't had a whole lot of problems. So
now, you know what he wants. I think he said his primary thing was gaming, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. And I would say if you can afford it and have the technology, he's building a new system, so I don't think a serial ATA drive is not that more expensive than much more expensive than an IDE drive now these days anymore. So I would say go with that. Now, SCSI is going to cost you a lot more for the technology and the drives. But if you're really looking for dependability, I do believe SCSI is the way to go.
I hear all these horror stories about RAID. You know, supposedly RAID, you're running multiple hard drives, mirrors of each drive. But you hear these stories. Like when we talked to John Buckman, he was talking, he had like a massive RAID array failure where just everything just fried.
Yeah, if you you can if you're not doing it right, or even if you are doing it right and you have multiple failures, that can ruin your whole system. But I'm not up on my RAID, or what's RAID 1? Is that striping or is that RAID 5?
That's 1 is striped, isn't it?
Right, and then 2 is what? Here we go.
I have to look it up.
Let's go I don't know, but if you have like multiple failures, then you start having big problems.
Yeah,
that's some scary stuff.
Yeah,
for
that's
me.
Right. One is mirror. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it can,
it's too long. It's too far past my work day today for me to have to think.
So I mean, if you're looking, I mean, for games, I mean, isn't it? You're looking at high RAM, really.
Yeah, lots of RAM, lots
really,
of processing.
Really, really, really high-end video
kick-ass
card.
Kick-ass video card.
Yep.
And is it really going to matter at that point if it's IDE or SATA?
No, it's not. Probably. Because once you load that stuff into RAM, it doesn't make any damn difference. So.
But, I mean, yeah, definitely go SATA if you can.
You hear about these serial ATA drives that have, like, you know, 10,000 RPMs.
Yeah, I would go SATA if you can swing it. If not, use, you know, EIDE would be fine for a gaming system. But like Dan said, make sure you get, you know, as much RAM as you can physically stick in there, as fast RAM as you can get.
Nice.
Yeah, big CPU. huge memory video card. You know, fast as you can get, nice responsive display and a fast CPU.
But if you're doing video editing, then you definitely benefit from, you know, faster disk drives.
Oh, definitely.
SCSI. Or SATA would probably give you a bit of better performance.
I had an Adaptex SCSI card that I had for years, man, and no problems whatsoever with it when I had it. And I've had IDE drives, and going back, I mean, I had some Maxer drives. I bought a bunch of them, and they all crapped out on me eventually. This is back in, like, the 10-gig drive days. Right. But lately, they've been pretty good. I can't complain. The bigger drives have been much better, I think.
Yep.
That's what we say.
I need to get a larger drive for the Myth box.
Yeah, for Myth, for video, you need lots of hard drive space, man.
After a while, you know, like, I mean, I don't record that much on it, thankfully, but it's going to need more soon.
Are you running Myth, Link?
No.
What do you run? You were just running your own script.
I just run my own little scripty, and I don't even run much of that anymore because I have a DVD.
Right.
I have a DVD burner.
So. Your scripts, you posted them online, right?
I think so, yeah.
I'll take a look at those.
I'm just using, like, Russ Pavlicek's scripts, pretty much.
Your scripts
were really nice for me.
Yeah.
I just want to check it out.
What is it, Bash script?
Yeah, they're just a little bash.
What were you using to record the show?
M encoder.
So you pull that right off the tuner?
Yeah.
Using M encoder?
Yep.
And it started at a certain time?
Yep.
So tell what channel to go to?
Just using we had just changed the channel and run it through M encoder, let M encoder grab it from such and such time to such and such time, encodes it off into an AVI, and off you go.
So I started playing around with Myth on there.
I've been playing around with...
Go ahead, Alan. I'm sorry. I didn't want to cut you off.
Oh, no problem. I found a script called Myth to iPod, which will convert, if you're running Myth TV, it's mythtoipod.com. It'll convert your Myth files over to a format that you can view on an iPod if you have it, if you have an iPod video on it. I'm trying to fix that so I can actually change it so that I can bring the files over onto my... I have a PlayStation Portable, which has a real nice screen for viewing movies and stuff on it. It's small, but it works really well. So I'm trying to convert that so I can get the videos to play over on the PlayStation Portable on it. Sort of there, but not quite. But it actually works really well if you had an iPod, I guess. I don't know. I don't have a video iPod, but...
What do you run in your Myth box on with distro?
I'm sorry, you cut out there. What'd you say?
What? We're on.
Dan, you're such a dick.
What are you running your Myth box on? What distribution are you running your Myth box on?
Slack.
Then you compiled that all yourself, right?
Yeah, I actually have to recompile it because once I put the stuff in for that, when I bought the card off of Pat on it, I never compiled up for like the remotes or anything on it, so I still have to compile to use the remotes, but I don't really use it all that much with the remote, so I'm not really... I either watch it at the computer on it, or I watch it on the TV. I watch it on the Xbox, the hacked Xbox.
Uh-huh.
I use that as a front end on it, and that works really well as well too.
And Pat, you're doing it from Fedora.
I'm not doing it anymore. The box that I was using as my MIT TV box is now my main workstation. That's why I sold the card to Alan.
Because I installed the packages from Ubuntu, and yeah, I should have.
I was doing Fedora.
I should have compiled it myself, I think.
You know what's really good? If you have a dedicated box, they have Not Myth. I heard that's gotten really good lately. It's like an ISO. You just burn it and throw it in the drive and install everything.
What about the installing like Myth TV from the Ubuntu repositories?
I don't know how it is.
No, I tried. I did that, and I had problems setting it up, and maybe it's because of the card I'm using, but it just... You have to sign... I didn't read the documentation fully, which is...
Yeah, typical. How typical for Dan.
that's the big problem that you have to do.
Yeah, that whole signing up for, what is it, the Zap? Zap it?
Zap to it.
Zap to it. It takes... Because I don't know if it was working right, but they said it would take a long time, but you'd run that initial thing to connect and get the...
it was pretty quick when I did
and
it.
And mine, it was like it would connect and it would wait and it would wait and it would connect and then it would drop you after a little while or something.
Well, the whole idea with that is to do it like at off hours, like, you know, 2, 3 in the morning.
Maybe. I shouldn't have done it at 8
o'clock.
Yeah, that
was actually one of their questions last month. I had to resign because you have to resign every...
Every so often, right?
Like 3 months or something like that. You have to go and answer the questionnaire again. And one of their questions was on it. We're currently getting hit quite hardly around midnight. Would you be interested in moving your downloads to a different time? I'm like, okay, yeah, whatever.
Yeah,
I only download about once a week, anyways, because the TV stuff doesn't change every day, every night, anyway. So you really don't need to download it, your channel listings every single night, I don't think.
Yeah, I've been hearing good things about Not Myth lately, so I heard it's improved quite a bit. Since I looked at it initially way back when.
And the problem I have is I got...
I've also been playing around with Replay TV, actually, as well. I got one of those for free. My boss gave it to me.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
And TiVo's actually got that one beat.
Wasn't Replay
interface.
Was Replay Microsoft's attempt?
Gut.
Was that a yes or a gut?
I don't know what the I didn't look it up. I don't know what. No, I said I don't know what the operating system was on that one. I never really paid attention to it. The only thing it has an advantage of is there's a bunch of programs out there that you can actually download whatever you record right to the Linux box or a Myth box or, you know, or not a Myth, but a Mac box or, you know, even a Windows box on it. Because they created a bunch of clients that actually fool the Replay TV into thinking it's another, you know, it's talking to another Replay TV. So if you record something, you can actually get it right off the box, which you have to sort of hack TiVo to be able to do that. But I think the interface on it sucks. I'm not going to... I signed up for it for a month. I think
what Alan
month runs
said.
Out, I'm going to cancel it.
Yeah. You know, I had an actual Bash Potter failure this week.
Oh, no.
On which feed? I think I know which feed you're talking about.
On all of them.
That unreliable Bash.
No, it's not Bash Potter's fault. What happened was I wasn't paying attention to the partition that I was downloading all this stuff on, and it filled up. And somehow, I don't know what happened when the partition went up to 100% and it couldn't save anymore. It tried to write back to the log file, and something got screwy in that process, and my log file disappeared. So the next time I'm downloading, I'm like, man, this is taking a long time. It was downloading everything.
Oh,
so I got all the Lug Radio again, and I got some of those feeds have, like, one was, what was it?
Daily Source Code with, like, 300 episodes?
No, I don't have that in my feed anymore.
I don't do that.
Was it Comic Book Geek Squad, I think it was, had every episode from 1 to 68 or 69, whatever the most recent one is. So I got every single one of those episodes. But and then all the ITCs and stuff like that. Still, I mean, it was my fault. Wasn't paying attention. But I was just sitting there scratching my head. Why is it downloading all these episodes that I've already had? I've listened to. What's going on here? It's because
you blew away your file.
The temp file got messed up, I think, when it went up to 100%. You need a Bash Potter for prawn.
Yep.
And prawn feed. Sure. You know what I want, and I've been probably thinking about sitting down and writing this, but I went out looking for spelling test software for my daughter, mm-hmm. and it's really, I haven't been able to find anything. Something that would, you know, say the word, and you'd have to spell it, and just to let her practice it. And the only thing I found that came close to it was a Perl script called U-Spell, and it's all command line driven, so it's a little, you know, complicated to start. And I'm thinking, it can't be that hard to write a little application. You know, it could probably even be, if he did it in Perl, you could probably put a graphical interface. What would you use? SDL? You could use SDL. You could probably even use X Dialog.
Right.
On top of that. Or even, you might even be able to write it in Bash with X Dialog.
Sure.
Or GTK.
Sure you could.
I don't think, because there's nothing out there.
Write in Bash, X Dialog, and, like Flight or something like that.
Right, and all you have to do is just. I didn't think about using Flight. The way that U-Spell works is, you tell it to create a list. You type the word in, you press enter, and then you quickly say the word, mm-hmm. and it saves it to an audio file. So it looks in that directory that you create the list, and it pulls the name of the file from what you typed. It names it the audio file the same name.
Mm-hmm.
So it pulls that name right there, and that's what it uses to test whether you. You know, it says the word for you. You type it, and it looks to see whether what you type matches what's on the screen.
Yeah.
Or what's the name of the file. So, I mean, I figured it can't be that hard.
I don't think it'd be that hard at all. I think it'd be a lot more fun if you used Flight or something like that, though, because then you could just have it, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you had...
You could just go through and listen to the words, and if they're wrong, you can kind of spell them a little bit more phonetically or something. But
do I have Flight online? I'm surprised I don't have Flight online.
Well, guys, it's 20 after. I got a gig that one.
Time for bed.
Time you could use Festival, right?
Festival, that's what Flight is. Flight is Festival Lite, which is way, way faster and easier to install, at least in my opinion. But anyway.
Anyhow, that was another episode. That was a good episode. Brad was a great guest.
Tux is asking me, are the new servers up yet? What new servers?
Yeah, what new servers?
What new servers? You're talking about my new desks, maybe?
The ones he's going to buy us, right?
Yeah.
A quad Opteron blade server.
The servers, the stuff that I've been doing at home, trying to get stuff going, is for those of you who haven't been paying attention to my weblog, which of course you should. I have had, you know, for the longest time, we're all driven by aesthetics, right? For the longest time, I've been looking at my old computer setup going, you know, it's getting really ugly, and my desk is falling apart, and then my keyboard drawer fell off at 2 o'clock in the morning because my cat broke it, and I had to duct tape it together a couple weeks ago, literally. And so I finally said, you know, screw it. I'm going to get a couple new desks. And I went to Walmart, and I found these black oak.
Where America shops.
That's right, Where America shops, and so does Link. I found these black oak computer hutches for what I thought was a reasonable amount of money. So I picked up two of them, one that I'm using for, you know, my regular desk stuff, and one for my servers. You know, I put my servers in one instead of this big old iron freaking 23-inch wide telco rack that I've been using, which is just, you know, a behemoth. And it has taken me a week to get all this crap together and moved, and like the wall behind, maybe last year, we painted my living room and the hallways and stuff like that in my apartment, and I never painted behind my computers because I could not get behind them, you know what I mean? Didn't want to move all that crap to get behind there. So I, you know, built these desks, and I tore my entire apartment apart doing this stuff. And then I had to paint that wall and put everything back together again. I finally got the crap, everything completed last night. And I just have not had time yet to post. I did take pictures, and I'll post them on my weblog. You can check that out. I'll try and get to that tonight or early tomorrow morning. And check the pictures out. You can see what the difference is. But it's pretty cool.
I want to play with Kayax, which is a soft phone that uses
the
IIX codec on Astros. See how the quality sounds compared to the SIP phones.
He wants to play with my ass.
And there's also Speaks, huh? Supposedly Speaks is very good quality, Dan?
Apparently. But what do I know?
What
yeah.
What phones support it, do you know? Or is that something on the server that you have to set up?
You have to have the proper codecs to support it.
Fizzone was on it. He probably knows. He's into Astros.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's still on, though. He probably bailed.
Probably. All right, listen, guys. Got to cut this down. Episode 109, Linux Link Tech Show. Very unique because there's only going to be one 109.
Go to the Frapper.
And this is it. Go to the Frapper thing.
We have a link on our main page. Go to that one.
It's pretty cool. Like, not very many people are on there, but if you look, it's really neat to see where everybody's from.
Yeah, if you went to mine that I wasn't paying attention to, and go back to the right one and put your name down.
Right. Everybody that listens to this needs to go to there and just register real quick so we can have a really nifty map to see where all our people are from.
And if you want a DVD, send us an email.
Yeah. DVD or CDs, right?
Yeah, CDs.
Dual
too.
CDs.
The CDs only have the audio files. The DVD's got all the extra cool stuff.
Yep. Make sure you send us an email. We'll get you information about getting those so we can get them right mailed out to you. Thank you again for all those people who have ordered DVDs from us, and especially the ones that, you know, kick in a little bit extra to help offset the cost of our operation that we have.
We appreciate everything you
give
us.
That's really, really
cool.
And it also goes to, you know, goes to show that you guys actually do enjoy listening to the show on a weekly basis, which is decent too. So again, thank you. 109, this is it. Please make sure you come back next week. Stay tuned for 110, where we will talk to Pat
I don't know.
Ooh, the mystery guest.
I don't have the calendar in front of me. I think it's Nick Petrelli from Tux Magazine. I think it's him.
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's him.
See him next week or the week after that. But anyway.
We got some cool guests lined up in the coming weeks.
We got all kinds of nifty guests coming up, so come on back, check us out next week and every week thereafter.
Hello there, Sailor.
Hey, he got it working.
Dan was able to get it working before we cut off.
I told you, it installs pretty fast, man. That's got to be flight. It sounds like the dude from flight, right?
Dan is demented.
Oh.
You got to have quotes on you, man.
Both,
you?
Oh, I have this.
So, yeah, that probably screwed it up. Oh.
What is it?
Maybe it's the comma.
Probably.
No.
Oh. It would help if I spelled it right.
Yeah.
Let's get that brain going.
That's pretty bad, man.
Yeah, that was.
You really can't understand what the hell that was.
Yeah, what are we getting?
It's Pat, let's get that train going. That's what it says.
Come on, ride the train. Woo, woo.
All right, everybody. We're out of here.
Here we are?
Good yeah, night. We are.
I don't even have music geared up yet.
Well, gear some music, man.
Oh, hold on.
Stop and store.
He's been over there playing with his train and his PMB there.
Let's.
Dun, 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 dun.
No, that wasn't our.
That was almost
our music.
He's like, damn, no, that wasn't it.
Alan, do you want to say bye-byes?
Good night.
Oh, crap. I gotta. This damn site is playing music.
What the hell are you talking about?
This show. It's Joe Rogan's site.
Okay.
Oh, come on.
If the site's playing music, dude, just, you know.
Close the site.
Close the site.
Here. Pat, go ahead and read that.
Which one? The Grizzly Man, Death by Horsecock?
Yes. Dude, you want to see a horrible video? Isn't that the way it always starts? Do you want to see a horrible video? Want to see something you shouldn't see?
Is it real? Is it bullshit?
Probably not.
Dude, it is real. The guy died afterwards. You want to see it, Pat?
Put it on.
I'm telling you, man, I don't think I want to watch it.
Disturbing.
It is.
I think I heard about this before. I don't know.
Dude, it is. I'm not going to watch it, man.
Does he get eaten by the bottom?
No, Pat, I'm telling you, man, this is your last chance.
Oh, the thing tries to hump him?
I haven't seen it yet. I don't want to see it, but I want to see Pat.
The grizzly bear tries to hump him?
No, it's no grizzly bear.
Big fat guy.
It's not a big fat guy. Let me get the play out some music. Everybody wants to be free. Everybody wants to be happy. What's that from? Everybody wants to put a smile on their face. No?
Don't know.
Real fruit, real fun. The ice is Rita's. All right. Be that way then. Thank you everybody for listening. Let's close you out of here.
Did you watch it?
Still downloading.
I know what he's gonna play. I heard some of my weirdo nifty buddies talking about this one. How they were blinded for life.
They call me.
Listen, if you ever get in my way again, next time I really will kill you. I'd like to see you try it, you lame excuse for a half dog. Pardon?
Inuyasha, sit.
You know I want to tap that ass, right?
While you were making egg foo young in the kitchen, I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's over.
That's the show for tonight. Now we're on to the AUG. AUG? AUG? Dun 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 dun. AUG? Of what? Did you get Slackware installed? Is it running well?
Yeah, it's up and running. I need to put those freaking network drivers on. Wireless? Yeah, the wireless drivers. What do you got in there? What do you use? The WNNG? Isn't there a binary package for WNNG?
Yes, it's on disk 2. It's on the under contrib. Or maybe it's disc 3. All right, Pat. There you go, man.
You want me to borrow this then so I can make copy?
Huh? Yeah, go ahead. I'm not using it right now. Pat, I'm telling you, man. You're going to regret this. You're going to regret it. You're going to regret it. You're going to regret it. Don't look, Link, man. I'm telling you. That is horrible video, man. That guy died after that, apparently. Look at you even knew better than to watch that. What would you even told Pat you weren't gonna watch it? Now you know what? I saw that on Friday, and I was just like numb for about a half hour afterwards. And I forgot it for a little while. I managed to forget it. I'm driving my wife to Borders after I picked her up from work, and there's a car in front of us with a bumper sticker that says, "I love my horse." And it was just like, no. No. Please, no. It's not illegal in Washington State, apparently. Yes. Well, everybody, I'm going to cut off this AUG here. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you next week.